My name is Jeff, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jeff.
This is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff. Make sure this speaker's up.
Yeah, we're good.
Real good.
Real good. All right, more about
alcoholism.
My name is Mark Gilman, alcoholic.
Hey, Mark.
Chapter 3, more about alcoholism. Most of us have been unwilling to admit we're real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is a great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times that we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grips of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. We are like men who have lost their legs, they never grow new ones. Neither does there appear to be any kind of treatment which will make alcoholics of our kind like other men. We have tried every imaginable remedy. In some instances, there has been brief recovery, followed always by a still worse relapse. Physicians who are familiar with alcoholism agree there is no such thing as making a normal drinker out of an alcoholic. Science may one day accomplish this, but it hasn't done so yet. Despite all we can say, many who are real alcoholics are not going to believe they're in that class. But by every form of self-deception and experimentation, they will try to prove themselves exceptions to the rule, therefore non-alcoholic. If anyone who is showing inability to control his drinking can do the right about face and drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to him. Heaven knows we have tried to hard enough and long enough to drink like other people. Thank you.
Thanks for your remark.
Thank you, Mark. I'd like to welcome all who are new to Alcoholics Anonymous or in their first 30 days of sobriety. If you would please introduce yourself.
Hello, I'm Sean. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Sean. Welcome. Any out-of-towners? We appreciate the church allowing us to use its facilities. We ask that all in attendance please refrain from using profanity while in and around church buildings. Also, if you're going to smoke, we got a cigarette tower in the on the corner of the building right here. Just put your cigarette butts in there, please. We have coffee and snacks over here. We have literature in the back. Some of it's free, some of it's not. If you can't afford it, we'll get you a book anyway. And stay after tonight because we have ice cream, and we also have cake because we're celebrating a birthday tonight. All right. And pony rides. Yeah, we got pony rides. We got donkey rides out back. Donkey. But we have a. We got a bounce house. Yeah, we got restrooms right here, as well. And we also have recordings of past Into Action speakers out on that table over there. If you guys want to grab those, just make sure you return them. Appreciate it. And I guess we'll get right into it. At this time, I'd like to introduce tonight's speaker. Please join me in extending a warm welcome to Jill.
Thanks. Hi, I'm Jill, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jill.
And what a pleasure this is. Steve's 30 years, and he doesn't look a day over 29. Well, this is a real privilege. I haven't done this in a long time, actually before COVID. But, I thought I was taller. So, what we do is, speakers don't have anything special. We just come and we share our experience, strength, and hope. What it was like, what happened, what it's like now. And it's such a privilege to do this. Especially people like Steve. Steve was here when I came to AA, and he's always had a special place in my service to AA and in my whole walk. So tonight is very special, just to be honored to be able to come and share his birthday, and then to be asked to speak. And some of my story is kind of funny, some of it's kind of tragic, some of it's darn ridiculous, but it's my story. My sobriety date is November 10th, 1996. And my home group is the Saturday Morning Women's Group, meets on Saturday morning in Portsmouth. I've had a series of sponsors while I've been in AA, and now I have some very cherished friends more than sponsors. I think that's one of the gifts you get from long-term sobriety. You meet people that you stay in touch with for pretty much your whole walk. But what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I never drank as a kid. I had a father that you didn't do too much wrong around. We had a very, very volatile household. I grew up on the coast of Maine, and we have alcoholism, both sides of the family. There were seven of us. Six of us are alcoholic. One of them died, but he was alcoholic before he died. But I'm the only one that's ever found the rooms. But I can remember telling my brothers, I get drunk and call them or something like that, and my brothers always said, if I ever get as bad as Jill, I'll stop drinking. Well, apparently they never got there because they're still drinking. And that's one thing that's kind of sad, because when you have coming from a family like that, it's hard to watch. But the truth of it is, this disease will kill you. But getting back to the story, I started my migration south the day after I graduated from high school. I was one of these kids that I knew I needed to move. I knew I needed to get out of that environment because I did not want to be like them. I didn't realize that alcoholism actually follows you. You don't really get to move from it. So I moved down to Brunswick, Maine. I was working, actually I worked in Augusta first, and I started in a job that really was my lifelong career. It was working in banks. And I got introduced to kind of fun people, and we used to date the sailors from Brunswick. And we'd go out on these different fun things to do. Really nothing really a big deal. It wasn't a whole lot of terrible drinking, but it was fun drinking back then. A lot of kind of shady little dive type bars, and then just kind of hanging out. And this is how I met my first husband. Okay, he's recovering from a bad relationship. We were out, everyone's out partying, and at one night he goes, "Hey, what are you doing next week?" And I said, "Nothing." "Why?" He goes, "Let's get married." I go, "Yeah." Okay. Unfortunately, that was how my thought process went for a long time. It was kind of funny, but we left before we left Brunswick, this is part that Steve always kids me about. I rode enduro motorcycles, and we would drive. It was, they call them dirt bikes now and everything, but it was called motocross back then. We would just ride the power lines, and just, we didn't ride on beaches in Maine because they have just really big rocks, and it's not a lot of fun. But we came down to Virginia, and one of the things that I came down in February, and I never wore a coat for several years I was here. I couldn't believe it was so warm, and I loved it. But we would ride those motorcycles on the beach, and we would just tear it up. And we were drinking some, but not a whole lot. And I always tell the part about one of the things that I want to, in Bill's story, he says he, when he was in the service and he got out, he said, I had arrived. Well, that's what I felt like when I moved to Virginia Beach. I have arrived. And one of the first things, you could ride on the beach in Virginia Beach on your, with your motorcycle. And I can remember riding with my yellow, orange, yellow bikini, terry cloth bikini, my motorcycle, and my boots. And I thought, I have arrived. I am hot, and I know it. I weighed about 90 pounds. You do, there's nothing 90 pounds that's hot. That's an attitude, you know? But for a long time, we just kind of partying, and we really, I don't know why we ever got married other than we didn't have anything else to do. He was in the military, he was on a long deployments. And the first year that we were together for any extended period of time, we really realized we didn't like each other. We really didn't. And so we both started dating other people. And so the marriage went south quick. But in that, I wasn't drinking nonstop, but I could see sometimes that my drinking was a little bit rough. You know, like if I had one or two, I wanted to have four or five. And I could work. I loved to work. I would work two or three jobs in between relationships. But when that relationship broke up, I was working as a teller. And that was the first banking job I had in Virginia was as a teller. But I was slowly taking classes and doing a lot of other stuff too. But I met a guy who had three kids. And I knew my drinking was getting a little out of hand. So I thought, he's got three kids. Kids, that's what's missing in my life. I need some kids. So I married this guy with three kids, and I would like to say that I stayed straight and on the straight and narrow for a long time, but I'll tell you what, if you want to fuel some alcoholism, throw some kids at it. Kids. I did the best I could, and even my stepson, I still have a relationship with the children, even though the marriage didn't last. We were married about 18 years. But I still have a close relationship with the kids because I raised them for 16 years. But what I found I needed to do in this process was I started having three beers and six cigarettes every night. And that was to take the edge off the day, to take the edge off having to be part of this family situation, which I was really ill-equipped for. But in there, we would, it was still manageable. I was a real exercise freak back then. I lifted weights and I jogged and I did all kinds of stuff, rode my bike and got rid of the motorcycle by now. But I was always going 90 knots to nothing. A friend of mine used to tell me, you spin faster than the top, you're wound up tighter than a tick. And I had to be active all the time. And what beer and wine did for me back at that time was it slowed it all down. It took the edge off. And I loved it when Vernon used to say, alcohol does different things to each one of us. What it did to me, probably no, it didn't do it to anyone else. What it did for me was I felt okay. And I started chasing that okay. And as I chased it, I was really quite successful in my job, and I was quite successful in a lot of other things, but I wasn't successful in relationships. My husband and my ex-husband now, we've been divorced for over 20 years, almost 30 years. I used to drink, and he'd get mad at me. And he'd say, why can't you have three or four? Why do you have to have the whole case? And I said, don't bother me. I'm okay. Well, sometimes I wasn't okay. And one night he's nailing the front door shut. It's a steel door. And we're not going to get, I'm not going to bust it down. But he was nailing it shut. And I had to sleep in my Bronco in the front yard. I became comic relief for our neighborhood. Because we were either fighting. One day he was chasing me around the yard with a broom for some reason, and he didn't catch me. But it was like, what are they doing? It was just, it was like chaos all the time. But in there, my drinking was becoming very serious. And I realized that this is escalating. It's getting to a point where I'm noticing it. I was taking some classes at the time at Wesleyan, and I had a paper due. And what I decided was I needed a glass of wine to do the paper. Well, I had the glass of wine, and then I dropped the class. You know, that's where I was going with all of this. It was becoming more important to feel the comfort, ease and comfort I got from taking those drinks. But in that, the marriage started going south. I went south, and then it kind of blew up. And I thought, well, that's it. I just need to get rid of that guy, you know? Come on. The kids were now out of school and on their own. And so I said, that was it. He was the problem. Well, after he and I split up, I was renting a house over here over in Portsmouth, and I realized that I started drinking more bourbon. I started only hanging around with people that drank like I drank. I started doing things that just, like at work, I was still working very hard. I really did fairly good in my professional life. But the people at work, I found out years later, about 7 years into my sobriety, one person said, when you're on the beam, nobody can touch you. When you're not on the beam, you terrorize everyone around you. I didn't see that. I was volatile. You didn't know who you were going to get when I walked through that door. So in there, I got into another thing. I said, oh, I need to do real estate. I need to make some more money faster. So I do really well anything that's academic. So I went to take classes, got the real estate license like that, and then sat in this office and tried to do real estate part-time and work in the bank full-time. So what happened was I made a lot of calls and brought a lot of business into the office, but I was a terrible realtor. I mean, I would show houses and stuff like that. I didn't really know what I was doing, and it didn't make a lot of sense to me. So God always does for me what I can't do for myself. In that year, I was being introduced to a lot of people that drank big time, really drank. And they liked to go to places like Atlantic City, Las Vegas, Bahamas. You know, wherever there's gambling and fun, we're going to go. And in that year, when I was trying to do real estate, I got cancer. So I had to not drink for a whole year. And I did. And they said I was too, so out, they thought I was really upset because I had cancer. But I was coming out of my skin. There's in the doctor's opinion, they talk about being restless, irritable, and discontent. Well, I was personified restless, irritable, and discontent. So what they decided was they needed to put me on some antidepressants because they thought, she's depressed. And if anyone that asks, my alcoholism looks like a lot of weird things. And at times it can look like bipolar, depression, all kinds of things, but it's not, it's alcoholism. And so I didn't drink for a whole year. And you know what, the day I got my clearance from cancer, when they signed off on me, I went and got drunk. That was such a relief. I went and got drunk. And that started a whole new cycle. And during that time, I was seeing a therapist, a counselor. It was a counselor first. And she said, I see you every week, you know, you pay your money. And you sit there and you tell her all your stuff. And she finally said to me, you know, Jill, you don't need to come back. I thought, damn you, I'm paying you, what's wrong? I'm not fixed, I have issues. And she goes, I can't help someone that won't help themselves. She was trying to get me to go to AA. And I thought, I'm not that bad. But to prove I wasn't that bad, I came to a few meetings. And I walked right out the door and go, whoa, I've been too hasty. I am not that bad. Because she has some horror stories. And I still was doing pretty good as far as keeping a job and that sort of thing. But what happened after her, I was still drinking, not unreasonably, I didn't think. And but I started drinking more alone. Didn't really want a lot of people in my life. And so I decided, when I was having those antidepressants, they say on the bottle, do not drink alcohol with this medication. And I thought they meant them, not me. So you have to go to a psychiatrist when you're on that kind of stuff. So the psychiatrist said, I will not treat you unless you go to 5 AA meetings. Well, I went to 6. I'm an overachiever, if there ever was one. But then I did the next thing, the next alcoholic thing that I like to do. I stopped going. I said, I don't need this guy. You know, I don't need AA, I don't need him. And that was in 1994. And that year, I also, one of the AA meetings I went to, I met a woman named Judy Kay. And she helped me. She helped me a lot. And she drove me to some of the meetings. And one day I didn't go. And she called me and she goes, hey, what's up? And I said, nothing. And she said, are you drinking? And for a change, I didn't lie. I said, yeah. And she said, you're just not ready. And she hung up. Didn't yell at me, didn't tell them, call me names, didn't say anything, just quietly hung up the phone. And that was in 94. From 94 until I came in 96, I went places I never would have gone in my head. As far as I was in the hospital for 3 days for alcohol poisoning. And what I did when I got home, I poured a glass of bourbon. I was standing at the sink, poured a glass of bourbon, and I was shaking. And I put some orange juice in it because I said, I need to get healthy. But what happened is that I started having blackouts. My work, I don't know how. All I can say is there's a lot of alcoholics in the profession I had. So I don't think they really noticed that I was as out of the ordinary. One of the guys I worked with, I remember, that goes into when I get sober. I'll tell you that afterwards. But anyways, they didn't really say a whole lot to me because I was really a good producer. I was pretty good at what I did. But what was happening there was I was starting to have blackouts. And then something happened, God doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. A cousin that I don't even know, really, came down to visit from Michigan. And I said, yeah, anytime you want to come, you know, Jeff, yeah, feel free. Well, she moved in like 3 weeks later. And she started saying things like, I'd be sitting on the back porch having a drink, you know, just a big drink. And she goes, I see we're drinking our dinner again. And I thought, damn. And I started taking the bottles from and whatever I drank that week, putting them in a black plastic bag in my car, and taking them to a dumpster somewhere in the city. I own the damn house. It's not like I'd have to pay for the rent in the trash can. It's my trash can. But I was hiding it. I was sneaking it. And in there, I had, my last drunk, y'all, is not spectacular. It's pretty embarrassing. It's pretty stupid. But I came home one night. I meant to have 2 drinks just to take the edge off. Some people were coming over for dinner. And I did. I had 2 drinks and went into a blackout. And the people came over. I guess we had a decent evening. But I played this song. I don't know if any of you remember Soul Asylum. Runaway train, wrong way on a one-way track. How'd I get so jaded? I played that sucker 30 times with tears running down my face. And I'm walking up the stairs. I have this wrought iron railing on my banister on my stairs. I'm walking up the stairs. I must have had something really important to say because I had my head between the ceiling and the banister. I got my head stuck up there. My glasses flew off, all wrinkled. And the next day, the only thing I could say about it is we have a moment of clarity in our drinking. And mine was, it's always getting worse. It's never getting better. I'm going to die a pitiful old drunk, and there's nothing I can do to stop it. So I wind up coming back to AA, and I didn't know what I was expecting or what was going to happen or anything else. But, and it didn't make sense. It didn't make sense for a long time. And there's two parts of this early sobriety that are really, really important for me. One is that I was around people that were really sober, that knew what to do with a drunk like me. They gave me little things to do. Drive this person to a meeting. Why don't you set up over here? Why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? And the other thing I realized is I was not drinking and I was not okay. I was really not okay. And I went to the doctor that gave me those antidepressants, and he said, and he was a gift from, he said, you know, Joel, if you're taking something that your body doesn't need, you probably don't need it. Why don't we just get you off all that stuff and see how you do? Because it was like I was doing everything through cellophane. You know, like nothing really seemed to be connected. So that took about a year for me to get okay again from that. But in there also was, I avoided Judy Kay like the plague for 3 years after when I came back in. But she never said anything to me. Nobody ever said, oh, you're that gal that came in and just split every time we tried to help you. No one said anything like that. But in there, they didn't shove Alcoholics Anonymous down my throat or alcoholism. Everybody comes to that on their own. And I came to it when I realized, without anything, any substance or anything in me, I'm not okay. I'm really not okay. And I can remember having these real deep discussions with people in AA. They say, you need to pray. I don't believe in God. And they go, it doesn't matter. And somebody in Craddock gave me this little orange piece of paper. For third step prayer on one side, seventh step prayer on the other side. And I'm pretty smart and I know how to do a lot. I could not memorize those prayers. I'm so resistant and rebellious and defiant. I'm dying, but I'm so resistant to what was being offered. But I would do what they said. They said, just get on your knees every day and read that prayer. I get on my knees, I look at the wall and go, we know it's a wall. And I'd read those prayers. Well, sometime in that year, I started realizing I felt okay. I wasn't plagued with wanting a drink all the time. And I wasn't plagued I had moments where I was okay. And I thought AA said, you've got to come here, and in step two, you've got to find God, and blah, blah, blah. And it didn't say that at all. It said, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Well, I've been to enough psychologists and psychiatrists and therapists that I could accept the insanity issue. I said, like, you know, maybe there is something to that. Maybe my thinking is a little askew. Maybe they know what they're talking about. So when they explained it to me, they said, look at the record. You know, people that are okay don't go to these kind of doctors. People that are okay don't drink like we do. So why don't you just try this? And I'm sitting there, let me think about it. You know, I love that. You know, I'm going, I don't do anything fast in AA. I do when I'm dashing around in my life, I tend to. But what happened is they were talking about step three, that we turned our will and our lives over the care of God as we understood it. Well, I thought, and then they talked about this key, and I went to a step meeting at that time, and they're talking about this key. Well, I was at a doctor's office one afternoon, and God really beats me along the head with reality sometimes, and this guy came up to me, and he said, do you have a tire iron? I said, why? What do you need a tire iron for? I think I got one in my Bronco. And he looked at it and goes, my daughter locked our car door, and my keys are in it. I looked over, he had a blue and white Bronco too. I had a red and white Bronco too that I bought up in New Jersey. And I had my keys in my hand. And I flipped them over to him. I said, here, try mine, they might work. He opened his car with my keys. Well, I go to a step meeting that night and they're reading step three. The key to this whole process is willingness. Willing to believe. Is there something? And that was my epiphany, my big epiphany. could I be wrong? Because I really held on to things. There's nothing that I can't do if I put my mind to it. I mean, that is like a man that I worked with for years. I worked at two different banks with him. He used to tell me, you know, your pit bull mentality does pay off sometimes. I thought it was a compliment, you know?
Yeah.
I got a pit bull mentality. But it's that I don't give up on things. I'm like a dog with a bone. I'm going to gnaw it to death. But in there, I became a little bit open, just a little nanny bit open-minded. And step three took me a long time. And to get comfortable with this idea of turning anything over to something besides myself. But another day of my surrender in this program was, I was really struggling. And I struggled for quite some time. And I wasn't really committed to anything because I couldn't figure it out. I'm always trying to figure something out. I was reading my big book in the backyard on this. I love sitting on my back porch over in Waterview. I was reading the book, and I was reading 86 to 80, 88, and finally I took the book and I heaved it across the yard, and I said, if there is a God, you're going to have to do something. Otherwise, I'm out of here. Something opened up again that day. And I was talking to my sponsor who was moving out of state, and I talked to her sponsor. Sometimes she goes, you need to call Judy now. You need to let her walk you through this process. I'm convinced there are people in AA that are put in front of us that we can hear. There really are. And they come in all different, and they aren't there for the whole walk. They're there for a season. Well, I did it. And that took a little bit of humility, not humility, it took a little bit of courage on my part to pick up the phone and call Judy, because I'd been avoiding her for 3 years. So I talked to her and we started really working the steps as they come out of the big book. I don't ever try to tell anyone. I've had a lot of people come to me with workbooks and worksheets. I said, well, let's put that aside. Let's go out of the big book, because that was what was done with me. And as we did that, I got to see why this program is so pragmatic. It works on a drunk like me when nothing else will. You can put me in therapy until you turn blue in the face, and I'll talk, but it doesn't have any effect on me. But when I did the steps, and the fourth step, my first four step, didn't really have a big impact on me, but the fact that I did the process, and I talked to my sponsor, and she helped me pick it apart, and then moved on, and in six and seven, I love six and seven in the step book. I will say that much about those two steps in that book, because in the sixth step, I'm getting okay that there might be a power greater than me. And in step seven, he's going to take away certain things. I didn't really understand it. Bill W. wrote it's in the language of the heart. If AA was a self-help program, we would, by this time, know what we were doing. We would take step six and we'd figure it all out and we'd go on. Well, I'm one of these drunks. Everything I've ever figured out, I was thinking about it the other day. My right ratio right now is like 95 to 5. Right 5, wrong 95%. So you get to see little things about yourself. But 6 and 7, you know, I'm making this decision, I'm moving forward. And then we looked at 8 and 9. 9 was a big deal for me because I had some major amends to make. And my amends were personal relationships. I had some very, I was raised by some, that's a nice thing to say, some very damaged people. But my sponsor used to say, why did you expect, especially my mom, why did you expect her to do something she never could do? She didn't treat you this way because she was being mean or she wanted to. She didn't have the tools to do it. So right now, you're going to have to learn to cut her some slack here. She did the best she could. We're looking at you. Disregard them completely. And then I could look at me because I looked at those children I raised. I made more mistakes and did things not perfect in any way, shape, or form. And my ex-husband, he used to tell me all the time, you lie as much by omission as you do by commission. And I thought, what does that mean? I can play dumb, but I didn't know. I didn't know. He said, you give people everything except for what they need. I had no clue what he meant. Well, as I do this process and I'm making the amends, I see what it is. It's like when I made amends to my mom. When I was in therapy, they had us write these letters. And we weren't supposed to mail them. We were just supposed to write these letters. I wrote the letter and I mailed that sucker. I caused more heartache. And my mom, I was sober quite some time because I was separated from them for a long time. My father and I have some very bad history, horrible history. But when I made amends to my mom, we were riding somewhere. I was taking her somewhere. And something was said on the radio or somewhere. She goes, yeah, that's right. Blame the mom. She's always to blame for everything. And that was the day I could make an honest amends to my mom and say, Mom, I was wrong. You did everything that you could to make our lives good. And I was wrong. You didn't cause my alcoholism. You can't fix it. And you weren't to blame for it. And how this whole thing works out, I use this example a lot because it really does play out. Maybe a couple years later, I have brothers that live right around my mother, and they drink terribly. And sometimes when they drink, they get out their guns. They're so drunk they can hit anything, but they sure can make a lot of noise. And they tend to want to go to my mom's house and tell her about it. And my mother said to them, she goes, Jill told me, I didn't cause your alcoholism, I can't fix it. But you're not welcome in my house anymore if you've been drinking. So my little bit of amends allowed her to be okay and to stand up for herself just a little bit. And the amends part, when it came to my father, I didn't have to make an amends for not being a good daughter. Sometimes amends is standing up to someone who really hurts you, or really does hurt. He didn't just hurt me, he hurt the whole family. And he was dying. My brother had called me, goes, Jill, Dad's dying. I said, do you want me to come home? I don't think so. He hates you. I said, Dad hates you. Dad hates everybody. Yeah, but he really hates you. Well, help of a sponsor, I started making trips to Maine. I didn't stay in their house, but I did visit. I did spend time with them. But what I learned to do in that time was to stand up and not be browbeaten. But when it finally, he didn't die real fast. Michael, when he talked to me, I thought he was going to die next week. It was 6.5 years. But he was in the hospital, he was dying. And he was just as angry and just as mean in that hospital as he was in our whole life. And the doctor came in and said, John, do you want a minister or priest to come in? A lot of people get comfort from that. He goes, I don't believe that crap. And he pointed out my brother, and he says, you don't believe it. And my brother goes, no, Dad, I don't believe it. And my sister. And finally he looked at me. He didn't say anything to me. But I said, I beg your pardon. I know there's a loving God. He saved me from a terrible alcoholic destruction. And he'll help you too. And he just laid back and went, oh. He never asked for to speak to anyone. But while I was in that hospital, he was dying. He was being terrible one day, and I left, and there was a little chapel in that hospital, and in there was a Torah, a Bible, and a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So it's so funny because in AA, God meets me here and there, and it weaves back and forth and back and forth. And life has been lifey, but I keep showing up at things, I keep walking and trying to help wherever I can. I've sponsored people that, you know, that just has been a delight. I've sponsored people that told me I had it all wrong, and they showed me their workbook. And I thought, hey, I'm not here to sell anything. I can just tell you what I did. And I can only tell you that this stuff really works. And in there, it talks about us becoming usefully whole. When I was 7 years sober, I had everybody in our division, we had a performance appraisal by the division head, and she goes, we don't know what you've been doing for the last 7 years, but keep doing it. Something's changed in you. That was the first person that really saw that I wasn't volatile, I wasn't just going nuts all the time, I wasn't trying to make everyone do what I thought they needed to do. But also in that, I got this 7 year sin I had this one guy that I had worked with for a long time. I walk in his office one day, he punched his computer. And he goes, "That computer just makes me so mad." I said, "Oh, he's not going to do it anymore, is he?" He's dead now. But they'd always put me around with other drunks. And I've met people in the rooms that I work with. But in all of that, one of them came up to me and goes, "You won't tell him, will you?" I said, "Well, I'm in the same room as you are. I'm not going to go tell him myself. And I'm sure not going to tell him you." So we see the fallacy of our thinking in other people. And sponsorship has a lot to do with that. I used to think people didn't do things because they were being mean or they just being hard-headed. They don't know. And if they're like me, I was so broken for so long. And I couldn't hear what people were saying to me. I listened to Don M. He sends out an email every day. And he talks about, we just help God's kids do what they need to have done today. And we pray for ease and comfort for them. I don't pray for ease and comfort for myself. One of the things that I've been listening this year to some online, I was listening to Father Martin, because people always say humility is not thinking too much of yourself and all that. And Father Martin says the most wonderful thing about humility. He said, humility is facing and accepting the truth about yourself. And that's what's been happening to me in the last 6 years, really. Just being able to see the truth about myself. I came to AA, I've gotten the rough edges knocked off, but I still got some warts. And I got some things that just don't look so good sometimes. But I do know how to get quiet and how to pray to a God I didn't understand or care about. And that's the other part of it. In the 12, they talk to you about the conviction of your beliefs are sure to come to you if you seek. And I have. I've done a lot of seeking. I know what I believe today, and I know why I believe it. And I get a tremendous amount of peace from what I do believe. And I don't try to sell that to a newcomer. I don't try to sell any religion or anything like that, but I say, if you want to know how to work the steps and not drink one day at a time, I know how to do that. And I know it works. I know a lot of people in these rooms that it's worked wonderfully for. As Tom H. used to say, this is $1 million education, nickel at a time. Mm-hmm. That's it. And I'm going to close. Because what are we doing on time? Timing's good. I used to tell a little story, but I always like this, because I wrote this in, this is the first little big book I had. And in here, it really is my first inventory, was I don't pay attention, I think I know everything, and I don't listen. Well, I still have some of that, but it's toned down. But well, I love this. Somebody said this to me one day, and this talks about alcoholism in the short form. A thought reaps an action reaps a habit reaps our character, and our character reaps our destiny. And AA is a character building process. And it's not so I can look good or just impress anybody or do anything spectacular. Is so that I can learn to walk comfortable in my own skin and not get too upset about anything that's being thrown at me and not try to tell you your skin doesn't fit. Thanks, that's all I've got.
Wonderful job, Jill. Thank you so much. And did a great job tying in the step of the month, too. I don't know if you did it on purpose, but I noticed that, so thank you. And you said that you were 95% wrong. I was about 100% wrong for the first 2 years of, probably first 4 years of my sobriety. And I remember one day I noticed I started saying some things right when I said something in a meeting, and my sponsor was in the meeting. He said, Jake hit the nail on the head with that. And I was like, I did? I was shocked. I wasn't used to having the right answers, and it took me a while to know what to say in certain situations. So, yeah. you did better than I did. Our seven traditions states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting. Declining outside contributions. Money collected at this meeting covers rent and supplies for the group. The rest is distributed to our AA service entities. Are there any AA-related announcements?
Hey, hi, everybody. My name is Stephen. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Steve.
The General Service Office is conducting a survey of members. The survey closed November 15th, and they're asking for individual members to participate in the survey. And the survey is on how to close a meeting at the 2025 International, whether or not to say the Lord's Prayer at the end of that meeting, or another, or something other than. So the survey is online at AA.org, and it only takes 2 seconds to fill it out. But I encourage you as an AA member to participate. Again, it's at AA.org, and if you took a tag on what's new and scroll down a few topics, the survey topics will come up. If anybody has any questions about that, they won't have to help me after the meeting. Thanks.
Well, thanks.
Hi, Steve.
I'm Steve, alcoholic.
Hey, Steve.
Next month, for December, this group, our Friday night speaker meeting is going to be a hodgepodge collection of speakers to end up the year. Speakers that we tried to get earlier in the year, we just couldn't get coordinated. So our speaker for December 2nd is Heidi Kay from Mark's Home Group. What's the name of your home group, Mark?
Indian River 12 and 12.
Indian River 12 and 12. She's a very dynamic speaker. On the 9th, we have Aaron H. from Faye's Home Group over there in Smithfield. On the 23rd, we have Danny S. from, I don't remember what his home group is. Virginia Beach. So, is he in Virginia Beach, Mark?
Danny Sheridan?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a Globe Outreach. One of those.
Anyways, we have some great speakers lined up, just not all from one home group. And then starting in December, we'll get back to home groups. Thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Any more announcements? All right. And Chips, here we are.
Hi, everybody. My name is Stephen. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Steve.
Thank you, Jill. It's been a long time since I heard your story. It's good to hear. I remember when Jill first came in. She got here just a little bit before I did, and I can remember sharing her early meeting that things started changing in her life, and she didn't have anything to do with it. I'll never forget that. It's a privilege to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, particularly to give out chips that denote different lengths of continuous sobriety. And the first chip is a white chip. Anybody who wants to give up the high cost of low living? Anybody interested in picking up a white chip tonight? We have an orange chip for 30 days of continuous sobriety. We have a burgundy chip for 60 days of continuous sobriety. We have a red chip for 90 days of continuous sobriety. We have a blue chip for 6 months of continuous sobriety. We have a green chip for 9 months of continuous sobriety. We have a yellow chip for 1 year or more. Anyone?
Diabetes definitely does complicate the matters, so I had gotten to the point where I decided I needed to stop drinking. I had just not decided when, and I made a move, and that move, I think something was mentioned about moves not affecting. It does affect things. I learned much younger that if I was to move, I have to build up a whole new personality. And so I've got to learn how to find out where all the alcohol is. And before I learned how to find the alcohol here, if I just abandoned drinking alcohol, then I don't have to go looking for alcohol. It'll just happen to not appear on my radar, and that has appeared to have been present.
Thank you, David. Thank you. This medallion that I'm going to hand out is to a member of a home group. Everybody knows it's Steve's 30th anniversary tonight. And if there's anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous who has taught me quite a few lessons, it would be Steve. We've been through a lot of things together, ups and downs and service work. And we, from time to time, didn't see eye to eye at all. But you know what's grown out of that is a friendship that is heartfelt and full of love. Come get this.
Good thing the meeting doesn't end until 10 o'clock. There's plenty of time. Now the second speaker. My name is Steve Roach, and I am an alcoholic. And I'm grateful. I'm grateful for everybody been here. Jill, thank you so much. Jill and Steve and I, there was a period about 10 years, 15 years. We just did a ton of service work together, committees and the district and all that. And we stood on the shoulders of the giants that came before us, like Ann Knuckles and Bob Britt. Leo's still with us, Ernie's still with us, Tommy Davies and Tom Hearn and all those older guys and gals. And they paved the way for us, and I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful that my wife is here tonight, my beautiful wife. She's been with me from the beginning. She was with me at my worst. And my granddaughter Isabella, the apple of my eye, she's here as well. In my job today, I am so grateful. Jill mentioned the Craddock Study Group. I was a member of that home group for 9 years. And it was my first real home group. And I got my first real sponsor out of there. And my life was transformed by taking the actions that were outlined. And my sponsor, we worked out of the big book and did the work. And that's all we did. There was nothing else. It was just the big book. And it was fantastic. And I loved it. And a miracle transpired in my life. And by definition, a miracle is inexplicable. And I can't explain to you what happened. All I know is I did the work and God came into my life and something happened. I was transformed. And so my job today is to make sure that should one day that little girl need to stand in this room, that she finds the same message of recovery that I found here. It seems to me that there's too much effort going on nowadays to transform the fellowship into something it doesn't need to be. You know, I'm here today because of the old timers that stood tall and stood firm, that this is what we got. And when I sat at Bill's kitchen table, and he's patting his big book, because I'm dying from untreated alcoholism at 3.5 years sober. And he says, get your book and come on over. And I'm sitting at his kitchen table, and he pats his big book. He says, kid, this is all we got. If this ain't what you're looking for, hit the bricks. And I intuitively knew that that's exactly where I was supposed to be. He taught me something about structure and discipline in my life, and I didn't know it at the time, but it's something I've been yearning for my whole life, was structure and discipline in a spiritual way. When I was newly sober, I wanted to join the military because I thought I needed some discipline, right? Luckily for me, I was too old and too stupid. They wouldn't take me. Because I got a treatment. I was like, man, I need to join the military. So I just wanted something for free. So I'm lazy and I don't like to work. But so our job, my job, your job, is to make sure that we keep Alcoholics Anonymous the way it is. It works just fine, just the way it is.
And I'm grateful that you all are here tonight, and I hope you stick around. We're going to have some great cake. And Steve, thank you. Steve, Jeff, and my wife and I, we all had dinner last night. And Steve went around the table and asking everybody what you're grateful for. And Steve, he asked me, what am I grateful for? I'm grateful for my wife. The answer was my wife. Because she didn't get me sober, but she kept me alive long enough for this thing to work. She didn't put me out. Because the first few years I was sober, man, I was crazy as a you know what. And she put up with it still. Because like Jill was talking about, the rougher edges get sanded off little by little, get polished up a little bit. So the lying, the cheating, the stealing, all that other stuff, that didn't go away overnight. The drinking and the drugging was taken from me that first night. But the rest of it just took a lot of work. And that's where the sponsor and the home group and the steps come in, because that's the difficult part, is changing that. Because my old behavior, my old way of thinking, always leads me back to that. Whenever there's a problem, I know how to fix it. I know what the solution is. $50 and a trip to the corner bar. Easy peasy, right? And so now that I'm in the process of getting sober, the solution has to be something else. And I found, and I guess maybe that's why we did so much work together early on, is because AA activity kept me busy. I was busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, so I didn't have time to go do all the crazy stuff. So I'm grateful for everybody. Jake, I love you, brother. Thank you. Have a good night.
Again, white chip. Anybody desire a white chip tonight? Congratulations, David, on picking up your anniversary. Congratulations again, Steve. And Jill, thank you again.
Thank you for chipping. Steve, he's my sponsor. He walked me through the steps. And as a direct result, saved my marriage and my life. And I'd like to see you. Thank you. All right. We at the End Action Group believe that one of the important keys to long-term contented sobriety is the effective sponsorship. If anyone here tonight needs a sponsor, please see me, and we'll make sure you get one tonight. Also, End Action is a home group. If anyone here is looking for an AA group to join, please see me after me, and we'll get you in. And that's it. You guys want to circle around? We'll say the Lord's Prayer.